Take a network break. Run your Ansible playbook to configure a virtual donut and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. We've got a special guest on today's show, Tom Hollingsworth from Tech Field Day. Today's show is sponsored in part by InterOptic. They offer high-performance, high-quality optics at a fraction of the cost, and you can find out more at interoptic.com. Okay, to the news. Bloomberg, they're back in the news with a story about a Supermicro hardware hack. This is a new story, but this time it's Ethernet connectors being compromised by implanted microchips. They cite a security researcher, a named security researcher, Yossi Applebaum, who says he discovered the implant on a server in the data center of an unnamed telecommunications company in the
United
States.
Can I just call this bollocks? Let's just start right off on the front foot.
You're starting with bollocks right away. Okay.
So again, Bloomberg has claimed that things that just don't exist. So if you actually read the article very closely, Yossi isn't actually saying he found an implant. He said they are possible. And he actually didn't say he found them in the wild. He said they are definitely a risk. And Bloomberg's now blown that up into that he found one in an implant in a telecommunications facility, blah, blah, blah. If you actually go and read, he was interviewed by somebody at a website called Serve the Home. And they got an interview with Yossi, and he basically just urinated all over Bloomberg's story and called them a pack of idiots in very polite language. Yeah.
Really?
So things like he seemed to refer to this as not a Supermicro problem. He said, we found it in different vendors, not just Supermicro. We found it not just in servers in different variations, but hardware manipulation on different interfaces, mostly network related. We found it in different devices across the network, even Ethernet switches. So what he's actually saying here is, I've seen it, but I can't tell you where I found it. And he's not picking on Supermicro particularly, although the Bloomberg article does. It's almost as if the journalists at Bloomberg really got it in for Supermicro in some way, or there's some motivation. But what his point is he's not saying that this is actually a known vulnerability and it's actually happened. He's sort of pulling back from that. What he's saying is we know there's a problem in the hardware supply chain. So I think this, again, Bloomberg seems to be beating up what is a potential issue, not a real issue.
I think that you're absolutely right, Greg. For some reason, there's a person at Bloomberg who has a very large battle axe to grind with Supermicro right now. And everything that comes out that's going to be a potential hardware vulnerability between now and 2020 is going to be, oh, look, Bloomberg thinks that Supermicro is about to delete all the data in the cloud due to this one little hardware chip bug. And the fact that they kept digging on it, and then, you know, the more you dig into the technical details, and this is what happened to the original story about what we're thinking now, maybe an IPMI bug or an IPMI chip, the deeper you dig into it, the less credible it looks. And one of the things that everybody was kind of shocked by and in the initial story was the lack of weasel words. And they're present in this story, as Greg just pointed out. It's not one vendor, it's many. It's not actually in the wild, it's a potential. In this telephone game, just somebody that Bloomberg picked up on and wrote their own story about, and the next thing you know, the end of the world is nigh and people are running around screaming about it. And I don't really feel like that's fair to anybody involved, because it looks like bad journalism heaped on a company that probably doesn't deserve it, and the security researcher looks like an idiot now.
Yeah. The other people who have made comments to Bloomberg on this issue have also walked it back. So it's not like Bloomberg hasn't got form here. And in fact, I think we talked about this last time we talked about it, Drew, which was the journalists involved here also have a history of conflating things. They had big beat up articles a couple of years back around Heartbleed, accusing the NSA of using Heartbleed. And yet years later, everybody believes that to be false. That's actually a false accusation. And they've come up with false accusations again. And these people have a history of a number of articles. So if you wander around the internet and research it, people are coming up and saying these particular journalists, or the one in particular that they're talking about here, he actually has a history of making big things out of nothing, of taking speculation and turning it into, you know, a big, big deal.
Yeah, I was listening to the Risky Business podcast. They did an episode on this, and they were also poo-pooing on the story, and they cited a couple of examples with Bloomberg either getting details wrong or maybe overstating the impact of something that had happened, particularly with the security story.
Yeah. Now, there is some credibility here, so I need to have a bit of a retraction, and we especially rescheduled the show. So last week, following this, I did actually make a comment that all x86 servers, or words to the effect that x86 servers are particularly vulnerable to this because of their baseboard motherboard controller, management controller. So on every server, there's a chipset and a separate computer, if you like, that actually controls the boot cycle, and there's various modules and processors and FPGAs that control the power on. So when you press the power switch or when you connect over an ILA. So what we're talking about here, this whole vulnerability resides around the BMC process on the motherboard and there's an app in there that actually boots. And you actually, most people know this as a HP ILO or a Cisco management engine or the Dell DRAC, right? And we've had a long history of very poor software development by server vendors in and around the BMC over the years. And they've all got their own proprietary implementations of this. Cisco Intelligent Management Center. But around about the time that Snowden made some revelations, everybody started to get panicked about hardware vulnerabilities and implants. And after last week, when I sort of said, I don't believe that any of the major vendors have actually got this under control, people from HP and Cisco reached out to me and pointed me to a whole bunch of documents about what they've done. This led me down a very deep rabbit hole. I've wasted an extraordinary amount of time reading about Intel TXT, which is Trusted Execution Platform, and TPM, Trusted Platform Modules. Now, these are silicon fixes in the Intel x86 platform. They also exist for AMD CPUs and ARM CPUs. And the TPM is a hard-cut silicon chip that actually contains a root of trust. And not only does it contain what I thought last week, a place in which you can store root crypto certificates so that you can validate stuff, they also contain engines, hardwired security capabilities to verify that the boot cycle that occurred in the BMC hasn't been tampered with post-shipment or post, like that the image in there is viable. So I have to take back what I said last week. It turns out that Hewlett-Packard, HPE, Cisco, and potentially Dell, I didn't hear from anybody at Dell, that sometime in around about 2014, 2015, these companies started to take supply chain security seriously, and they also started to take implant security in their supply chains. So I have to take that back and say that those two companies, certainly HP and Cisco, I didn't read up about Dell, have certainly taken steps to secure their supply chain. That said, it's really easy to compromise employees, and none of their security supply chain talks about employee validation and employee monitoring, and I wonder why.
Yeah, and I think going back to this story you referenced with Yossi Applebaum talking to a different publication, it sounds like he's saying that there are potential issues in the supply chain that we still need to be aware of. And so if Bloomberg got this completely wrong, there are still supply chain issues that I think we all need to be concerned about, and it needs to be taken very seriously, maybe closely re-examined.
I think the hardware implant is a complete beat up because it's much easier to compromise the software.
Sure.
You could make a story along the lines of, you know, this is fictional, but it's a credible story that you could go to India, compromise a group of Indian employees with some suitable amount of money, not a lot, and tell them to code up something that's along the line that you want. Maybe you only have to compromise three or four.
Yeah.
If you were Supermicro, you might be able to get your, you know, if you're a national security service, you'd be able to get a few employees employed there and get them into a position where they could do it internally. Now, that could just as easily be the British Secret Service, the Australian Secret Service, you know, the NSA in the US, or even the Chinese. And in some cases, some criminal organizations would also be able to do that. And this is what I pointed out last week, is while everybody's pointing the finger at China, there's actually no evidence here that it's anybody, that it exists. And even if it is, there's no evidence that it's China. And you can't actually prove anywhere where it would be without actually showing us the actual evidence itself.
Yeah, that's true. But I also do feel like the supply chain with its layers, with contractors and subcontractors and sub-subcontractors, a lot of it happening overseas, it's something that folks like Apple, Amazon, Cisco, HPE, Dell need to be taking very seriously and be very careful about.
Yeah, but the majority of this motherboard design is done in India today. Some of it's done in China. China tends to more the consumer electronics. I was talking to somebody about that, and they said, you know, China doesn't design most of the motherboards. Most of that's done in India today. You know, it's not even...
They've outsourced the outsourcing.
But none of this security stuff, none of this supply chain security talks about, you know, the integrity of the workforces attached here. And I think that is probably just as, like, if I was trying to vector in on these companies, that would be my attack point. Do a little bit of human, go the human angle. Yeah.
I agree that software and the human layer are probably the easiest to attack. Yes. All right. Well, we'll leave that there. And I'm sure there's going to be more follow-up we can talk about.
I'm bored. I hope not. I'm bored of this issue because it's all bollocks. Like I said, there's nothing here. And I think the surprising thing for me out of the research I did around TXT and TPM is just how much effort these vendors have put into their supply chain integrity. Now, the flip side of this, let's just take this one step further. If you want to get into conspiracy theories, you will also note that you're losing your right to repair, because the more this supply chain integrity stuff comes into place, you can't replace components because that's the same as a hardware implant. So we've seen Apple, there's a new feature in the latest MacBooks where if you change it with third-party gear, like if you change the hard drive out in a, as a repair, Apple has to have a piece of software to enable that to be installed, to be activated. So they're actually putting crypto keys in the hardware so that when you plug new components in, apparently it's not enabled yet, if I remember the story right, but we're getting to the point where, you know, if your server breaks, for example, you won't be able to just put in non-white box or OEM or third-party hard drives because they just won't work. And the vendors will be able to say to you, oh, that's supply chain. We can't let you put third-party components in. You can't repair this. You can't upgrade this because supply chain. And that also, as coincidentally, seems to address the gray market. So we see vendors get really upset about people buying product lower price in, say, Indonesia and then shipping them over to America and selling them. This also solves that problem. So there is some, you know, if you want to be a bit mysterious about how you take these things, did the vendors put this security in place to solve their supply chain issues, or did they do it to solve customers, or did they say, we're going to do it to solve our problems and make it so it's a customer feature? You know, you decide.
All right, moving on. Juniper Network CEO Rami Rahim has declared that billions of dollars are going to change hands in a multi-cloud world, and Juniper is claiming they are poised to get some of those billions from companies like Cisco because of Juniper's multi-cloud approach. And that was Rahim's message from the keynote stage at Juniper's NextWorks 2018 Customer and Partner Conference.
So this is you were at the conference, so maybe you should kick off this discussion here, Drew. Do you really feel that Juniper is getting into the enterprise then? You felt that they see the enterprise as the future for Juniper?
I think they still very much see service provider as absolutely core to their business, and they're leveraging service providers as a way to get into the enterprise. But their whole approach is that, I'll sort of walk down what I took away. First, they're saying enterprises need some kind of operational consistency if they're going to do multi-cloud, meaning you can't have a bunch of services in AWS and Google and Azure and run them like you do on-premise just by hand with manual configurations and so on. And the key to get that operational consistency is essentially to mimic what the big cloud providers do, which is to have an orchestration engine and a uniform automation and software policy. And so they're saying, we've got the tools for that. Contrail Enterprise Multi-Cloud Orchestration Engine and Junos becomes your sort of uniform underlay. So that's their approach to operational consistency, yes.
Okay, I can go with that up to a point. No, I mean that genuinely in the sense that there's only so much of that that we can sort of so much of that story that makes sense, because yes, orchestration is here, but what we're also seeing is vendors are saying that SDN is very slow. Customers are saying it's very confusing. We don't understand how to proceed. We need trusted partners in place. So we've seen, you know, VMware sell NSX, you know, when NSX came inside of VMware, they were able to get customers to line up to queue by that. Cisco ACI hasn't been quite so successful, and none of the other Cisco's other SDNs have dominated the market. There's and what I mean by that is normally when Cisco comes into the market, smaller players don't even get a run. Like they don't even get to start. Startups don't even exist. There's usually three or four startups. Cisco buys one and the other three collapse and die. So, and yet we're not seeing that dominance from Cisco anymore. So I can get into part of that story. I mean, Tom, you got any ideas?
I actually was talking to VMware just a couple weeks ago about their new virtual cloud network strategy, which sounds an awful lot like this. As you guys have already mentioned, this is where they're positioning NSX. It's going to be a compatibility layer to enhance clouds, because there was a report that was released earlier this year that said that customers are in average in about 3.5 clouds, and they're experimenting with about 1.5 clouds. So, you know, half a cloud, I don't know what that is, but you average it up and you've got five different cloud environments that you're all trying to plug into. And that's a difficult nightmare to manage for anyone, whether it's shadow IT or anything else. And the way that you're going to be able to get your foot in the cloud door is to convince people that you have a solution that will allow them to meld those clouds together to make everything work. Now, will it work? That's a question for how well can you glue all of those pieces together? Because we've already fought this battle, and Greg probably has a nice rant built up about resellers just assuring people that we can interoperate company A and company B, their networking gear, because how hard can it be to make OSPF work between two devices? And where are we now with that?
Yeah. I think increasingly my view of the multi-cloud is you may actually have multiple clouds. So AWS, Google Cloud, Azure, but you may actually not connect them together except over the public WAN, over the internet. It's not a given to me that I need one network in every cloud.
Yeah, I don't know that necessarily saying that this strategy is about connecting those clouds. It's just about having one operational model and one essentially configuration or orchestration layer, or I'd hate to say it, but single pane of glass to manage all these individual cloud instances, whether it's public or private. And I think Tom's right. VMware is telling the exact same story with NSX. Juniper is telling that story now with Contrail. We've heard Cisco start to talk about multi-cloud, and they're doing what they usually do, which is a, don't worry, customers, we're going to get there, so just hold on. But all the big vendors are seeing it. I think Juniper saying this is smart for them because it gives them an opportunity. Like Contrail becomes a wedge for them to get into the enterprise. Say you decide to try Contrail for managing your public cloud instances and you like it, maybe you'll bring it on premises. But it's also the only story they can tell because that's what they've got. They've got Contrail and Junos.
I like that too at the same time, because one story means one hammer. And if I'm getting hit over the head by one hammer, at least I know where it's coming from. Whereas, you know, when you engage Cisco, they've still got four different SDN strategies, and two of them at least, and three of them in the enterprise space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it DNA? Is it ACI? Is it SD Access? Is it SD-WAN? Which one, you know, like you're getting hit by sales reps from all over the place and you don't actually know where to start. Whereas Juniper's coming in and saying, we've got Contrail, we're going to use that for SD-WAN, we're going to use that for campus, we're going to use that for the data center, we're going to use that for the cloud. We've got one tool. Nice. And you know what? The secret to easy selling tools like this is that you actually get deals done because you've got one tool that fits all. At the end of the day, once the tool's through the door, you make the tool fit your company, or you make your company fit the tool. It's always a bit of both. But I do actually think that, you know, once it's through the door, yeah, you're right, you may start using it to. But I don't think, again, just because you've got Contrail and you put some service into Google Cloud doesn't necessarily mean you're going to extend your network into Google Cloud.
No, not necessarily. Yeah, but if you can use, well, it's sort of like Big Switch, where they rolled out essentially run your on-premises data center like you would in AWS. So you've got essentially a single set of constructs that you're using to manage your network regardless of where it is. And I think that's what they're saying. Single policy, single construct, lots of uniform APIs so that you can do all the third-party integration you have to do. But also, as Tom mentioned, once you start to peel back the layers and really take a look inside, that's where all the ugly plumbing and duct tape and hairy connections start to come out.
If you want to automate, like if you want to automate the cloud, most people go onto AWS and then write for AWS's networking. Having another layer of indirection, or it can be useful, but having a layer of indirection that makes the AWS network coherent with the GCP networking, coherent with the Azure networking, sounds like a really good idea until you get into it. And then you start realizing there's a whole bunch of AWS services you just lost access to, like
that could
DNS
be,
or load balancing or threat management system, right? Because once you have a multi-cloud, you now have to build your own threat management system. Just as an example, if you're on AWS, you can use AWS's threat management system to manage all of the things. And it's nice and simple. Just turn it on and you pay and you just use APIs to program it and so on and so on. If you now start multi-network, multi-cloud networking, GCP and GCP hasn't got a threat engine. So if you want to have the same capabilities in both of them, you've got to deploy your own threat capability, and then you're back into the 1990s where you're manually doing everything from a startup. So yes, you need it if you go, but once you go down this path, you are actually building up secondary issues, and you need to keep your eye on the game here. Definitely, there are definite advantages to Contrail. You throw your Ansible or your, you know, and the networking suddenly fires up. You've got routers and you've got the NetConf and the Yang, and you can configure your Junos-based devices, and they are going to give you telemetry and visibility. So your legacy network and, you know, your focus network that you're running all comes together. Yes, I agree.
That's all part of the story.
That's all part of the story. But I'm not necessarily convinced that running SDN controllers to pave over the cloud with a networking strategy is solid design strategy or solid architecture. I think we may see less of that. But that doesn't matter, because we definitely need to orchestrate the network in the enterprise. We've still got campus, we've still got Wi-Fi, we've still got SD-WANs, and we've still got the data center to orchestrate the physical data centers, and Contrail could be an answer for that.
So one more Juniper story, a couple more Juniper stories. Obviously, you're going to have to use automation if you're going to live in this multi-cloud environment like they're talking about. And so they're actually rolling out some tools to help people. One of those tools is NRE Labs. This is a free browser-based training tool. It teaches network engineers automation principles. It was developed by Matt Oswalt. Some of you may have seen him at Tech Field Day events before he went over to the vendor side. But I've played with it. It's very easy. It's actually just a website, and it actually in the back end spins up sort of live instances that you can play with, and it walks you through some workflows and lessons.
Yeah. I had a quick look at it. You know what's amazing about this is it's free, as in free for money, but free to access, or you don't even need an account to get started.
Right. They're not even looking to get your email so they can spam you. You just show up.
Which I find, this is a real turnaround. Now, this is a Juniper effort. In the past, Juniper's put everything behind paywalls or block what, you know, you have to give up your details. And just Juniper has a long history of everything that it does. It wants to put behind a registration wall, and you have to give away your personal details to access even the most basic of marketing white papers, which is incredibly frustrating and annoying, and why generally I don't bother with Juniper News, because it's just hard to get to. Seriously. But this is free all over, and I was really sucked into it, and I started playing with it and working on it. It's just really, really impressive work from Juniper here. So very impressive. Tom, you had a look?
Well, I noticed the announcement. I haven't had a chance to take a look at it. But as soon as I saw whose name was attached to this, it all made sense to me. And this really, you mentioned, Greg, that Juniper has not had the best track record of making things freely available. That is changing. And we all know why that's changing. Mm-hmm. Juniper's done a really great job of hiring some of the best and brightest minds in the community recently and kind of putting them all in the same general area and telling them to do awesome things. And Matt Oswalt has always been a huge fan of make it free, make it freely available, make it so that people will want to consume this knowledge, because the rising tide lifts all boats, especially when it comes to automation. The more people spend time learning how to automate their networks, the more time they spend learning how these principles work, the more intelligent all networks are going to be. And if it just so happens that you learned it on Junos, I'm just saying.
It doesn't hurt. Yeah, so if you want to check this out, go to labs.networkreliability.engineering or just search NRE Labs and go check it out. One more Juniper story. In keeping with the multi-cloud theme of workloads on-premises and off, Juniper has announced a partnership with Nutanix. They're making hyper-converged infrastructure, of course. Juniper's Contrail Enterprise Cloud is going to integrate with Nutanix APIs, and initially Contrail Enterprise Cloud is going to provide a network visibility, and the long-term goal is for Juniper to manage the network fabric. They're also making their VSRX firewall software available to run on Nutanix for micro-segmentation and security controls.
So again, with the partnerships, so how many times in the last 6-12 months have we talked about Nutanix is partnering with Google, you know, whoever it is this week? So, you know, partnership of the week, Nutanix and Juniper sort of thing. We're going, remember we used to have a foundation of the week?
Right, we did. Yeah, Linux foundation of the week. Now we've got a partnership of the week.
And so this week it's Nutanix and Juniper. So there's all different ways to look at this. Nutanix and Juniper is having a partnership, but Nutanix is partnering with everybody who won't lie down, you know, who'll stand still long enough to put a press release out and say how much they all love each other. One of the things that strikes me about this is, are we seeing what's replacing standards in an era of SDN? And when we actually have to start federating the SDN controllers, what I mean by that is Nutanix has a software-defined controller of some sort, right, in its strategy, and Contrail is one. So now what we have to do is get those two things talking together. We don't have any standards around SDN federation or software-defined federation. There's no ways of defining standard interchange because all of these vendors have gone off a long way down their paths. So these partnerships may actually be the only way where we're going to get interoperability. And I'm beginning to look at these partnerships and think this will eventually lead into a converged effort where they define standard APIs, because partnerships are expensive. Vendors have to put people on the ground. They have to fly to each other's premises and have meetings and congratulate themselves on how clever they are and have steak dinners to, you know, so they understand each other. And, you know, partnerships are really expensive to do. And it's a lot easier just to have a standard and say, well, we comply with the standard. Then I don't have to have a whole team of people whose job it is to manage partnerships.
At the same time, Greg, standards are easier to write to, but they're harder to get developed. And if anybody's ever been to an IETF or IEEE meeting, you know that that's basically like it's chaos, it's bedlam, because people want to argue that every little thing has to be included in the standard and it all has to be voted on and everybody has to agree. And we all know that compromise is what everybody gets when nobody gets what they want. Whereas a partnership, you go to Juniper, Nutanix, Google, Cisco, EMC, Dell, any company in the world who's doing this push. And when you're like, okay, well, we want it to do this. No. If you want to partner with us, you will do what we say. And when we get enough people who partner with us and do what we say, sure, we might open it up to everybody else. Because guess what? Now we are the de facto standard. And how many times have we seen the de facto standard emerge from something that was either a company effort, like you know, Cisco Super PoE, or even better, the standard emerged that was the exact opposite of what the de facto standard was, just to make somebody mad?
Yeah. It just, in my mind, eventually they're going to end up, these companies are going to look at this thing and go, we've got 200 people managing our partnerships, you know, and they all cost, like, if they're all in Silicon Valley, they're all costing like $500,000 a year to have them there. So it's like, wow, what do we do next? We have to get rid of this cost. It's got to come off. So we'll get a standards initiative going, and in 2 years, the standards will be done and we can get rid of all this headcount. I'm just saying.
My impression is that APIs and open source software have sort of become the de facto standardization layer around which people are bringing their products together. Your APIs, you expose some capabilities and you say, okay, this is what I'm showing you. You want to write to that, you go ahead with your own APIs, we'll make it work. And then open source, of course, that's why everybody's into open source. It becomes, again, instead of a standard implementation, it's a standardized code set. So I think that's where we're headed.
Yeah, I do. I just, you know, had at the end of the day, all these partnerships are all fine and good. And yes, we have to go and deal with other, but you know, when Juniper or Cisco or whoever's doing the partnerships ends up with 20 people full-time working with salespeople from the other companies, they sit there and start going, why am I paying all this money to get these partnerships in action? And where's the sales? Where's the revenue? And it's often not visible, and it always seems to fall down. So like I always say, you know, like I always say about partnerships, if you're going to partner, the only way you know the partnership's ever going to work is if you put a ring on it.
If you buy it.
Yeah. There's friends with benefits, and then there's, you know.
And then there's the marriage.
Then there's, yeah.
Okay, just a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Interoptic. And Greg, you're going to let us know what's going on with Interoptic.
Well, you know, Interoptic, they've been on the show for quite some time. They make SFP modules that you want to buy. So as high bandwidth activities are getting up, you're going to require smart decisions at the optics level. You want to have interchangeable and working. Now, Interoptic understands you're going to need a more nimble layer zero, and that means they support a full range of products you need today and you don't yet know you need tomorrow. Because, you know, when all those optics and all those switches, you don't want to be stuck with this optic only works in this switch and this optic only works in this switch, and therefore you want to hold spares or you have to rely on vendor maintenance. And as we all know, vendor maintenance is generally getting worse as the years go by. So having interchangeable optics is really important. This layer zero, if you like, is more important than ever. And you need to know how to spec these optics so that you can move them around your network and then you can change them as bandwidth demands. Many of us are getting into switches which are 10 gig today, 25 gig tomorrow, 100 gig afterwards. You need to be able to just change those optics around and need help to do that. So stop paying OEM prices from the vendors for optics and start talking to optics experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. And don't be fooled by lesser optics. Don't get down into the cheap. The difference between generic third party and brand equivalent optics does actually matter. You can purchase the same, if not better performing optics designed by engineers who truly understand how optics work at a fraction of the cost, and Interoptic will get you to take control of those optics purchases. So get your optics from the company that spends a lot of time thinking about what the future of optics is going to look like. As your network gets more complex, you'll want to work with optics experts who know how to troubleshoot problems when the lights go out. Head on over to interoptic.com, and if you get the chance, tell them that Packet Pushers sent you.
That would be great. Okay, back to the news. Google has announced the beta release of Cloud NAT, Cloud NAT, for its Google Cloud platform. The service lets VMs or containers running in the Google Cloud access the internet through a NAT gateway so that the VMs and containers don't need their own external public IPs.
I guess this makes sense when you think about it. I mean, containers, for the most part, don't really need to talk to the outside world, and giving them some kind of connection mechanism to communicate with the one server outside that they need to do, it makes the most sense in the world, especially when you live in the times that we have now where registered IPv4 address space is at a premium. Mm. Will this product live much longer? Well, first of all, it was made by Google, so it's already started the death clock. But the second thing I'm thinking is that when IPv6 becomes more prevalent in the world, you're going to see that this kind of falls by the wayside simply because it won't be as necessary. Now, what you will see take its place is there'll be some much stricter controls about whether or not containers can talk to the outside world through Google Compute Engine.
Well, you need to provision these things. A lot of containers need to access GitHub to do Git deploys and having a single outbound gateway. But a lot of containers or a lot of internal services just don't need to be reachable from the internet at all.
And that's the idea, yeah.
That's the idea. So you don't need a firewall. You don't need to have a bunch of protections. Not everything should be accessible unless it absolutely needs to be. So I imagine this is actually in response to enterprise requests. This looks much more like a standard enterprise template. And you say these servers just don't need to have inbound access, but they do need outbound access for updates and patches and deliverables and deploys.
Right. Yep.
And I'm actually kind of surprised this isn't here. This is not something that I would have expected to not be available.
I know. I was a little surprised too. Like, really? This is new?
Yeah, this is why Google Compute, like GCP, is so far behind Azure and AWS. Like, Azure and AWS has this, I think, been for some time.
It's also continuing the trend we're seeing with cloud providers adding more network services. I think it was a couple of shows ago we talked about Azure making network taps available so that you can send packets to your favorite packet capture or accelerator device. Yeah.
AWS continues to say you have to fit in with us, but it looks like Google and Azure are doing much more to speak the language of the enterprises to make it easier for us, you know, for enterprises on board. Different way of going about the same thing.
We've got some other Google news. A Wall Street Journal report says Google quietly killed a security vulnerability that could have exposed Google Plus user data to third-party developers. The vulnerability had been around since 2015, with the company only shut it down this past March, and they also never actually disclosed it until the Wall Street Journal said, hey, I think we heard about this vulnerability. Is that still around?
Yeah. Well, the thing here is that they found the vulnerability, but they believe that nobody ever accessed it.
Right. They think it, yeah.
So then they basically made the decision to close down. So the problem here is the fact that they didn't disclose it. Though I guess they thought at the time, since it was never breached and it was never accessed, there's no point in going public with a potential vulnerability. And perhaps the worst thing here is all of the press coverage of this has actually said Google was breached. It wasn't breached.
Right. There was the potential for a breach,
yeah,
but it wasn't breached.
What's going on here, of course, is that with the level of paranoia going on in the U.S. government and the Senate hearings and Google not turning up, people are using this to beat Google over the head and saying you had a cover-up.
Well, the thing is, the Wall Street Journal cited an internal memo from Google saying that they actually didn't want to take it public because they wanted to avoid another sort of Cambridge Analytica-like scandal that, you know, got Facebook a lot of negative attention. But now they've got it. They wanted to avoid it, but they did not.
We run into this problem all the time. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that Google did disclose it. And they would use a whole bunch of weasel words, which they always do. And everybody does. We think someone might have had an opportunity to maybe do this once, but we don't know. Which the press then turns into, yep, they were hacked. And The fact that this was the straw that finally broke Google Plus, well, one, makes me happy. But two, should tell you, if there was a vulnerability that 500,000 people were exposed and nobody accessed it, that should tell you how popular Google Plus was.
I know. It's really kind of pathetic.
So just to go off topic a little bit, the scuttlebutt I've heard is that there are teams of SEO professionals around the world weeping into their collective keyboards right about now, because apparently this has been a well-known way to juice up your search results, is to just go onto Google Plus and spam it, because the SEO bot, the collector that Google runs, actually regards Google Plus as a primary source of data. Now, of course, that was originally done to encourage people to go and post on Google Plus. There is some impacts here that you don't necessarily see, but I would be quite happy not to live in a world where there was no SEO experts, preferably, honestly.
Well, one of many things, yes.
Yeah,
I feel like in the end, disclosure is always better, because they say nothing happened, that's fine. And I know you can get beat up for disclosing, but when you don't disclose and then it comes out that you on purpose didn't disclose, that looks even worse. You're not going to win either way. So better to be upfront.
Well, and now that GDPR regulations in place and the whole, you know, like,
well, yeah,
the whole
that's
of
whole
Europe
other issue.
Says, yeah, that's right. This is why it's in place. This stuff should have been disclosed. But more importantly, now that everybody has to disclose, there's no shame in disclosure because you're forced to disclose. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah, it should be.
And you know, Facebook is actually, the EU is going after Facebook for its thing because to check its vulnerability, what sort of disclosure, and did they share it in timely fashion? So interestingly, these disclosures are having an impact. So Facebook's share price is now down 30% in the last 6 months. The suggestion is that investors basically think that Facebook might be, there's no more growth there as it reaches saturation, of course, but also because so much of this is leaking into the news, into the mainstream news, that people are going to bunk out of Facebook and the share price is dropping because it's not going to make any money in the long term. So a lot of its long-term value is disappearing.
Yeah, and I don't want to tie that directly to the disclosure of the breach. They were having problems well before that, first with Cambridge Analytica, and even before that with, you know, Facebook being manipulated for the U.S. election.
Oh, the Facebook vulnerability is much worse because what is known is that very private, very personal information was definitively accessed, and not just for 500,000 accounts, but they talked about 50 million. and they speculate up to 90 million. I would expect that number to go much larger.
Well, actually, we have a story about that. It's going smaller, but we'll talk about that in a minute. some quick financial news for you. Arista shares are down 30% at the time of this recording. And Greg, you pulled the story to our attention.
Yeah, I pulled this in at the last minute. So basically what they're flagging is that Arista share price has been dropping away quite a bit recently. And it would seem that shareholders think that their transition to the enterprise is not going to be so easy. And Arista's got most of its growth. So it's had this quite strong growth over a period of time. And the share price has had this massive run up to where everybody started to say, is it overpriced? Is it overpriced? So this is more of a correction, but 30% is quite a lot of correction. That would be one thing. The second thing I would be looking at is that people, for Arista to enter the enterprise, it means it now has to go head to head with Cisco and Juniper and Extreme, who are entrenched, whereas Arista really hasn't focused on that. It has to break into the campus. It has to find Wi-Fi. So all of those are risks. But more importantly, they're going to have to spend a lot of money building up a sales force. The enterprises are used to people knocking on their doors and buying steak dinners instead of just selling product at a fair price and being smart and buying what they need. Most enterprises like to have everything given to them on a silver platter with knives and forks and a butler, and that costs money, but they always seem to be happy to pay for it. So I think in a previous show, I mentioned that Arista said on their financial results that their cost of sales was less than 8%. Remember I flagged that a few weeks back?
Mm-hmm.
If that goes back up to where Cisco and other companies are, usually the cost of sales is 40 to 60%. So 40% is normal. So if it's got to run up its cost to that sort of level to compete, then the profits are going to drop away and so investors would be selling out. So that's where I think the share price. Arista's doing fine. The share price is just down. I think it's a market correction. And as they transition to try and get more growth in the enterprise, they're going to incur more costs and some risk.
That makes sense.
Sell out, lock in your profits.
All right. Some other financial news. Imperva, they make web and database security products. They are going private in a $2.1 billion deal with Thoma Bravo. This is a private equity firm with a long record of taking tech companies off the public market.
Yeah, it's all the rage at the moment with security companies to acquire them and then merge them. And Thoma Bravo is always one of those businesses where they buy something and then they tend to merge it with a couple of others, or they take bits of the company they buy and sell them off, flog them off separately, or throw them in the bin. So they basically restructure and then usually in 2 to 3 years, spin them back around and send them out into the market. So what we know is that Imperva would be, I would say to you, is more of a yesterday's company, very much built on the DDoS protection services. And it's got a whole bunch of smaller companies that it's acquired, but it hasn't really unified them, because in the public market, you have to deliver on your profit statements. Taking them private will let them restructure and then probably come back out. And we've seen companies like Cisco buy threat management services and really build up the cloud-based stuff. And Imperva doesn't seem to have that yet. So I guess this is probably a chance for them to rebuild it.
Yeah, that's my take as well. Tom, any input?
Yeah, we're starting to see this in a lot of other places too. A lot of companies have been spun out and sold to venture capital. And the very first thing that all the insiders say is, I wonder when we're going to see this again with a slightly different label on it when they re-release it. It's the old GE mentality. Find some synergies between a whole bunch of the crap that you own and then sell it to somebody else who loves those synergies so that we can use the money to then go buy more companies. I think that's Thoma Bravo's like mission statement in a nutshell.
Yeah. I think Imperva is just a little tired, but it can't restructure because it's a public stock. So taking it private gives it a chance to restructure. And perhaps we'll see it take its DDoS service and DNS capabilities and turn them into a cloud service like Zscaler and Edel, you know, all of those online threat management services.
Okay, some other news. Broadcom's proposed $19 billion acquisition of CA Technologies has gotten the go-ahead from EU antitrust regulators. According to Reuters, this was the final hurdle for the deal. So Broadcom expects the acquisition to close November 5th.
Yay. Still shaking my head about the CA acquisition.
Still don't understand it. Yeah, head scratcher. But I'm sure the EU antitrust group was like, yeah, whatever, go ahead. Yeah.
The only way I can think about this is if they're literally thinking about taking CA and busting it apart and selling the pieces out for revenue to go fund a different acquisition. Because remember, Broadcom is still smarting from the fact that they couldn't buy Qualcomm. I'm surprised they're in acquisition mode right now, especially for non-chipset related things. This feels like there was a piece of CA they wanted and they figured we'll sell the rest in a garage sale and make up the difference.
Either that or it's got some accounting tricks that it needs to run to keep the numbers going. So you buy something to...
Yeah, that could be. The garage sale trick was what they did with Brocade. So they've done this before, yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't make any money out of selling the pieces. They just got rid of them. The only thing they kept out of Brocade was the Fibre Channel business unit.
Yes.
And by bringing it, because it's a static, like there'll be no further development of Fibre Channel going forward. So they can just, and it's got 10 to 20 years of, you know, people will continue to buy Fibre Channel. So it's just raw profit and the cash flow that they spin off that. So in theory, they've got a lot of money ready to buy Qualcomm and now they're just using it to buy CA because they think they can. Still, it's a software business, not a silicon business. So it does not seem to be in Broadcom's warehouse, but everything is software these days. Maybe they see this as a way to pivot into software more.
Yeah, maybe. All right, our last story for the day, and this is one we signaled earlier. Facebook has revised down the number of users hit by a recent data breach. They initially said it was 50 million. Now they're claiming it's 29 million, and they still also claim that attackers have not used any of the stolen data to log into other sites using Facebook credentials.
I've seen articles that suggest that would claim that it definitely has, like the stolen data is showing up online and definitely has been used. So, and quite honestly, if Facebook says something, at this point, I think they're lying. It's very hard to find them as a credible, you know, that their claims are credible. And of course, we can't do anything to audit these or validate these. We just have to go on their word. And the press release you're talking about was pretty mealy-mouthed. It wasn't like, this is absolutely true. It's we think, we hope, we pray. We're trying to be nice to us, honest. We're not that bad. We know nobody likes us, but honest, come on, you should like us a bit. We're not that bad.
It was only 29 million. Come on.
29 million. You know, that's nothing. We gave away 500 million in the Cambridge Analytica. Surely this is better.
Why don't you go pick on Equifax again?
Yeah, but with Equifax, that's invisible. Like, I can't think of very many people that regularly access their credit report. Whereas if you are, well, if you're not a person who's security minded or is not just completely fed up with what's happening on Facebook, you log into it hourly. And for the possibility that that login could cost you some kind of crazy information, most people don't think they're affected by this. But boy, if there was a Facebook login for your bank, do you think people would have flipped out by now? Because it's like, oh, hey, I'll just click this Facebook login. And the next thing you know, some guy who accessed this information through some spurious API suddenly can drain my bank account. Yeah, there'd be a much bigger investigation. Yeah. It doesn't affect them because it doesn't affect them directly. It doesn't cost them their livelihood. It doesn't cause people to go out and impersonate them online. And that's why Facebook can get away with it. Oh, hey, we think someone might have done it, but we really don't think anybody did. Don't run away yet because we need you for the next quarter to keep Wall Street happy.
Yeah, I think overall what we're seeing here is just how lazy Facebook has been around security and securing data. It just hasn't cared. It's literally not bothered. So when you're using Facebook accounts to log into other people's websites, the reason that websites drove that so hard was because they got the data about you from Facebook and Facebook didn't care. And so their actual security implementation of that login was really poor. And so anybody could break into that. So I think what we're seeing here is that Facebook actually doesn't really care about your private data. Its goal is to share the private data. It doesn't take any good steps to secure that data. Everything that it knows about you, your name, your age, where you live, who your friends are, that's all basically public domain at this point.
Yeah, and I think maybe why Facebook sort of seems so shell-shocked about their sudden emergence as a pariah company is that they've told people all along, we don't give a crap about your privacy. We're not about privacy. We're about connecting and sharing everything all the time. And we've been telling you ever since we first started, we don't give a crap about your privacy. Why are you hassling us now?
If you really wanted to get the data, honestly, just go and compromise a Facebook employee because they can get access to it. I mean, I'm sure they're tightening it up now and starting to control who can get access to data inside. But for many, many years, you know, as long as you had a login, you could get pretty much access to anything. There's very little segmentation of data inside of Facebook. And that's exactly not what they want. That's why they fight so hard against all of these governments pushing pressure on them to secure and to segment and control, because everything they do then makes it harder for them to write new software, to develop a new generation of product, to, you know, buy products like Instagram and integrate them and then share all that data around. They don't want to. And you want to ask yourself, do you really want to be in a situation where your data just keeps spewing out online? All of your personal habits, your personal likes, your fetishes, your weird habits, you know, if you're buying your medical records, everything. Facebook would just throw it out all out on public if it could. And that is not the world that we want to be in, I don't think.
Nope. All right. Well, what a note to end on. But this wraps up this issue of Network Break. Tom, you're on social media and you blog quite a bit. Where can folks get more from you?
Oh, there's a lot of different places you can check me out. Networkingnerd.net is my blog. Networkingnerd is my Twitter account. That's me. If you want to see what I do for a living, you can always head over to techfieldday.com or gestaltit.com. I do much of the media stuff all over the place.
Greg, how about you?
You can find me on the Twitters as at Ethereal Mind and also on LinkedIn. I still haven't retired my Google Plus, so if you want to get over there for one last time just to give it a rub. I did actually find that my Google Plus is getting used. Did you know that?
I haven't looked at my Google Plus probably in a year and a half, so maybe I could go check it out.
Because we use these automation systems to push out our social media updates, it goes to Google Plus, and I kind of haven't bothered. When I actually looked at the analytics, it's actually there's people engaging with it, or some robots maybe, but you know.
SEO people.
But there you go. If you have some nostalgia, go and do that. And I'm steadily rolling back my etherealmind.com blog. I am over on Packet Pushers blogging more regularly. So if you're used to my little thought explosions where I pop out little articles and so forth, you should subscribe to the Packet Pushers blog feed where I put out my little reactions where I highlight articles and little pieces of information and share them with you as blog posts. And they're in packetpushers.net/blogs.
He pops it out, or you could add another O to that word and get a different description of what he's doing. But there it is. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsor, Interoptic. And of course, thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook if you're still there. A recommendation on iTunes is always appreciated, or even better, just share it with your friends. You can also check out our membership program. That's at ignition.packetpushers.net. It's got free and paid membership options, and it includes Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation newsletters, plus exclusive member content, including forthcoming VDC Virtual Design Clinic videos. So go check it out. And as always, thanks for listening.